Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, filling in for April Wolf while she's out of the country. She's tossed me the keys to the station wagon for the month of June, and I'm so excited and honored that she is trusting me to take care of this girl gang. And I thank you guys for going with me on this journey as well. So every week on Switchblade Sisters, we invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today, I am beyond thrilled to have a true icon here in the Maximum Fun Studios, the one and only Adrienne Barbeau.
Thank you, Katie.
I'm so honored you're here. I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm a huge fan.
Well, you may not be thrilled after we finish talking, but let's see.
Oh, I will be thrilled. Don't worry. I have lots of questions.
Okay.
I'm sure most of you know who Adrienne Barbeau is, but I will give you a quick bio of her fascinating career.
Long, at least.
Adrienne Barbeau was born in Sacramento, California, and caught the showbiz bug while entertaining troops on army bases in Southeast Asia as a part of the San Jose Civic Light Opera. She moved to New York City in the 1960s and made her Broadway debut in Fiddler on the Roof, co-starring with Bette Midler. Adrienne went on to star in more than 25 musicals and plays, originating the role of Rizzo, hello, in the Broadway production of Grease. This is huge for me.
That's what we could have talked about. Yeah. Of course, I've never seen that movie either.
Oh. So. And little, you know, fun fact, nominated for a Tony for that role. From 1972 to 1978, Adrienne starred in the sitcom Maude as Carol, the daughter of Bea Arthur's title character. Another whole podcast we could do about Bea Arthur. And she was nominated for a Golden Globe for that role. She also made appearances in numerous TV series, movies of the week, and game shows. But in 1980, Adrienne starred in her first theatrical feature film, John Carpenter's The Fog, as silky-voiced radio DJ Stevie Wayne. The film was a success and established Adrienne as a genre film star. This led to a string of horror and sci-fi films which have become cult classics, including John Carpenter's Escape from New York, Wes Craven's Swamp Thing, and the Stephen King adaptation Creepshow, directed by George Romero. She also starred in comedies such as Cannonball Run and Back to School, and of course, Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death. I haven't seen that one, but I really want to.
It's worth it.
Okay,
it's worth it.
I'm absolutely positive it is. On TV, Adrienne has appeared in The Drew Carey Show, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, General Hospital, Carnival, Dexter, Grey's Anatomy, Criminal Minds, and Sons of Anarchy. She's also lent her voice to the role of Catwoman on the animated series Batman, the animated series, and Gotham Girls, as well as many popular video games including God of War 3, Halo 4, and Mad Max. Along with her current voiceover, stage, film, and TV work, Adrienne has also released her own folk album, written a memoir, penned three vampire novels, and she is currently the host of the Shudder podcast, She Kills, which is another podcast about women in genre and horror films. She has several film projects in the works. Many are premiering currently, and two upcoming series based on cult favorite Adrienne projects, a reboot of Creepshow, and a series based on Swamp Thing. And a film adaptation of one of her vampire novels, Love Bites, is also in pre-production. Whew! I love that bio. It's amazing. It was so hard to
cut it
down.
I love it, too. Can I take it with me when we leave? thank you for writing that.
But thank you so much for being here. It's truly an honor to talk to you. And you have chosen the 1975 Sidney Pollack thriller, 3 Days of the Condor. Can you tell us why this is one of your favorite genre films?
When you first asked me to be on the show and said, you know, we need to know your favorite genre film, but it can't be one of yours, I thought, well, I'm screwed because I don't watch genre films. I think 3 Days of the Condor is my favorite because it's probably one of the only maybe three films I've ever seen more than once. And the other two didn't fall into this genre. The President's Man.
Oh, well, that's very similar film.
In a way, it is.
Yeah,
now
you know, Robert Redford,
yes.
1970s.
Yes, yes. And so I think it's probably my favorite. I love espionage. I love spy thrillers and things like that. I don't like horror. I don't like to be sitting on the edge of my seat with that kind of terror and tension.
Well, we'll have to talk about all the movies you've been in.
But I do like espionage. And so, you know, I stumbled across 3 Days of the Condor, probably saw it when it first came out. And all I really remembered was Robert Redford. And the setup for the trauma, you know, with him leaving the office and going out to get lunch and coming back, and everyone is...
It's an amazing opening sequence.
Yes,
it really grips you. So I'm going to give a little synopsis of the film so that everyone can be on the same page while we discuss it. But right now, I have to give a little warning. For those of you who haven't seen 3 Days of the Condor, today's episode will contain spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like April always says, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause the episode and go watch 3 Days of the Condor first, now is your chance. All right. So 3 Days of the Condor is a 1975 political thriller directed by Sidney Pollack. The film is based on James Grady's book, 6 Days of the Condor, and was adapted for the screen by Lorenzo Semple Jr. and David Raphael. Robert Redford stars as Joe Turner.
I work for the CIA. I am not a spy.
Codenamed Condor.
We read everything that's published in the world.
A bookish CIA researcher analyzing books and other texts for codes and hidden messages. One afternoon, when Joe steps out to grab lunch, a team of gunmen led by the mysterious Joubert, played by Max von Sydow, ambush the office and shoot everyone on sight.
Mrs. Russell, with the Kirkus report, this...
Joe discovers the bloody scene and immediately contacts his higher-ups at the CIA.
You're in violation of secure communication procedures, Condor.
Listen, you son of a bitch, I'm telling you, I came back with lunch and it was raining and the whole house was murdered. Everybody is dead.
They make plans to bring him in.
1 hour from now, at exactly 15:30, I want you to enter that alley from the 73rd Street side.
But Joe has a funny feeling.
I'm not going in any alley with you or anybody.
During a planned meeting with an agent named Wicks, who has Joe's friend Sam in tow, Wicks shoots at Joe and shoots and kills Sam, while Joe escapes. This event sets Joe off on his dangerous journey throughout New York City while he attempts to evade the assassins, trying to kill him. He impulsively kidnaps a young female photographer, Kathy, played by Faye Dunaway.
Your assignment for today was to go out and kidnap a girl.
And seek shelter at her apartment. He presses her into helping him, and their connection turns romantic, of course. Joe and Kathy kidnap his CIA contact, Higgins, played by Cliff Robertson, who reveals that the CIA hired Joubert to kill him.
Come on, Higgins, who'd hire him? You don't look up Joubert in the yellow pages.
That's right. It would have to be somebody in the community.
Joe tracks down the name of Leonard Atwood, the CIA director of operations for the Middle East, who ordered the hit on Joe and his office. Joe recently filed a report on a certain book containing a hidden code, and Atwood suspected that he had uncovered a secret CIA plot to illegally seize oil fields in the Middle East. It's all about oil.
Boy,
very
you got
prescient.
So much more out of this movie than I did.
While Joe confronts Atwood at his home, Joubert arrives and kills Atwood, having been hired by even more higher-ups at the CIA, who feared Atwood had gone rogue with the oil fields plot. In the last scene, Joe meets Higgins in Times Square and confronts him with the information he's learned. Higgins defends the oil field scheme as merely a contingency plan that would serve the American public in the event of a fuel shortage crisis. But Joe lets him know that he's already leaked the information to the New York Times, insisting they'll print it. The film ends on an ambiguous note as Joe fades into the crowd. So it's very complicated.
It is very complicated.
There's all of
this. But you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. There's all of this layer upon layer of information and misinformation, and as he, you know, he's sort of like this everyday guy.
Yes.
But as he like peels back more information and goes higher and higher, he realizes this huge plot to seize oil fields, which doesn't necessarily seem like it's sort of pie in the sky scheme in the sense, but really what's happening is like it's on the ground, the danger, the immediacy of him running around New York and being shot at by these CIA agents who he's ostensibly working for.
Yes,
and
yes.
All of that.
The good guys are not the good guys.
Exactly.
You know, now that as you're talking about it, I just realized they just recently remade this for maybe Amazon Prime or Netflix or one of the streaming series.
They did make it into, I think it played last summer.
Yes, yes.
And it stars Max Irons, who happens to be the son of Jeremy Irons.
I didn't realize that.
He's quite handsome.
I did watch the whole thing.
Oh, you did?
I never made the connection.
So you did watch the series?
Yes, because it was based on 6 Days of the Condor, and the movie was based on that.
And how did the series hold up?
it held up. I enjoyed it. I remember that.
It's very of its time, and that's something that I wanted to talk to you about like when it was released. And a lot of the research I was doing about the film, you know, Sydney Pollack was constantly being asked if it was like a politically reactionary film because it was released in 1975, September 1975, and Nixon had resigned in August of 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started shooting 3 days of the Condor in October of 1974. And then in December of 1974, all of these reports came out. Seymour Hersh for the New York Times wrote all of these reports about the CIA wrongdoings. So all of this was in the news and people were like, wow, they're making this film that's right on top of what's happening. And Sydney Pollack was actually like, no, I just made this film, but we happened to be quite prescient at the
yes,
time.
Yeah. In watching it again now, the only real problem I had was with, I thought it worked the way he connected with Faye Dunaway. Mm-hmm. You know, he basically sort of kidnaps her.
Kathy, where have you been? Here, let me give you a hand.
Wait a minute. I don't know.
Shh, don't do anything. Be quiet. Get in the car. Don't make a sound. Don't be dumb. Come on, hurry up. Get in.
Listen, please don't hurt me.
Where do you live? Where do you live?
Brooklyn Heights.
Alone?
I live with a friend.
You live alone. Come on, let's go.
The coming together in a romantic way was a little shoehorned in for me.
Yeah.
Know? I mean, they've only known each other a day or two. And
also, what about Ben? He's waiting to go skiing in Vermont.
Yes, yes, yes.
Like she has a boyfriend.
That seemed a little dated to me, but
yeah, it watching it now, that especially their sex scene and their romance
yeah.
that blossoms over the course of a couple of hours, it doesn't sit quite right.
No.
And you're like, this doesn't
no.
really work. But
no.
I did read that Sydney Pollack's, you know, he was never really interested in films unless they had a love story.
Really?
So, you know, he had just done The Way We Were with Redford and Streisand, and that was a huge hit. And apparently in the book, there's a female accomplice, but he changed the role so that it was more of like that Kathy, the Faye Dunaway character, would be less of a willing participant and then also have this romance. So it was kind of a more nuanced, complex role. And it is a difficult role, you know, for an actress to
yes.
play those moments of, oh, I'm a kidnapping victim, but now I'm kind of in love with you.
Or even, oh, I'm a kidnapping victim, but I'm sort of beginning to trust you. I mean, he could have,
right.
you know, and maybe I'll help you a little bit. He didn't have to take it all the way, but he did. So that's what it is.
Right. So I think Sydney Pollack was kind of the driving force behind that that love story. But there is one moment where, like, I do think Dunaway brings a lot of intelligence.
She does, yes.
To this performance. But she says, he ties her up, and it's kind of a disturbing scene. You don't really want to see Robert Redford, who's this dashing movie star, treat a woman like that.
I want you to answer the phone.
I'm not answering any phone.
Answer.
You answer this phone, then I'm gonna brave son of a bitch.
Get
you
in
are.
Here and answer. Pretty casual and nice.
And she says, "Why'd you have to tie me up like that?" And it's sort of because she questions it, it's like we question it too.
Mm.
So I did enjoy some of those moments where you see that nuance, that questioning, where she sort of draws us in.
Why did you have to tie me up like that? You thought I'd call the police. I wouldn't have.
You've played a lot of different types of characters and roles. Like, what did you think of Faye Dunaway's performance, and like, how did you connect with it or relate to that at all?
I thought she was very good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I connected to it. It was a hard line to walk
mm-hmm.
because of the way he grabbed her, and then she had to come around to.
It's a pretty complex arc to
yeah.
play, because she goes from terrified victim to maybe trusting him or believing him, and then trusting him, falling in love with him, kidnapping a CIA agent.
Right.
And then eventually saying, like, it's never going to work out.
She went off to Ben, right?
Right. And just sort of saying, like, yeah, I really like you, but you're in deep.
Yeah.
You're in deep, man. Would that we all had those revelations about problematic boyfriends. But yeah, it's an interesting performance. But I do think that, yeah, watching the film from this time period, it's like, yeah, I don't know if that would really fly today. But I do think some of the political stuff feels really fresh and actually real, even
yes,
in our
and
present
timely,
day.
You yeah. know, thank God for the New York Times.
Exactly. And,
although, correct me if I'm wrong, it's sort of, the ending is ambiguous. He sent the material to the New York Times, but there the CIA is saying to him,
how do you know they'll print it? You can take a walk, but how far if they don't print it?
They'll print it.
How do you know?
There's a real question of whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that their far-reaching tentacles are very
yes.
influential. So one of the things that I think is interesting about the film is that the book was originally about a heroin smuggling ring, and Sidney Pollack actually changed it to this like CIA oil fields thing. I'll just read one thing that he said about adapting the book. He says, the plot of the book was kind of corny, as were the characters. It was intended as a quick read in the airport book. But what it has was an incredible setup, like we were talking
That's
about.
That's what drew me to it, what I remembered.
It's so immediate, what that opening sequence, and really well done. So he says, so we borrowed that and created a whole new plot. The oil thing really came out of nowhere, and we didn't know then if it was far-fetched or not. Then he said, I wasn't interested in heroin. It was boring. There were a million pictures about dope, and also I wasn't interested in bad guys and good guys. I was interested in something much more complex. The 60s were just over, and I was remembering what happened when all the cops were referred to as pigs. I thought it must be a bitch if you're a really good cop. Suppose you're a really good cop and you know that there's a bomb in that trunk, but you do not have the legal right to search the trunk. What would you do? So the metaphor was, suppose there were a group of people inside the CIA that know about an impending crisis, but also know they can't do anything above board about it. That they know for a fact that the oil supply, if it was choked off, could bring this country to a standstill. So it's interesting because I think the film has a much darker view of the CIA, but you can sense that Pollack is kind of trying to understand their motivations for these plots. And at the end, Cliff Robertson says, oh, the oil field plot is just a contingency plan in case there's a crisis. But I think what comes across in the film, or perhaps just from my perspective, is like the CIA is evil, the government is
yeah.
evil.
Yeah.
But Pollack has this really like moral conundrum, especially for the CIA character. And I do think Cliff Robertson is kind of one of the more interesting characters in that, because he is kind of justifying the means to the end. Like, oh, I'm doing this for the American public. Like, what if there's a fuel crisis? So it's an interesting film. It's his approach to it was more complex than I expected it to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, did you see this film when it came out in 1975? It had to have been like a
I must have. Because
the cultural context of it must have been...
I don't remember at the time.
Yeah.
It's just...
That's just me looking back and like being like, wow, it must have been crazy. But you know what's interesting is like I was rewatching Escape from New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, Escape from New York is a lot like 3 Days of the Condor. If you think about it, it's like one guy in New York trying to evade nefarious forces.
Mm-hmm.
He's being manipulated by the government. And he doesn't know who to believe. And he's sort of like on the street trying to survive. I love that in 3 Days of the Condor, it's like very much, you know, shot on location in New York City and running around. It's like he's always in motion. So it was interesting for me to think about some of the parallels between Escape and...
Interesting.
Yeah. Had you ever thought about that?
No, I had not.
Yeah. I don't know. Perhaps just watching the two films back to back, it was like,
yeah.
Oh, wow, there are some real... connections there. But, you know, I love Escape from New York. And that was the second film you made third film you made with John Carpenter.
No, Escape was the second film I made with John. Well, no, you're right. That was the third. It was the second feature film.
I see.
I met John on a film that he did that was originally supposed to be a feature for Warner Brothers, and then they decided they wanted it for the small screen. So it was on NBC called Someone's Watching Me.
Right.
With Lauren Hutton mm-hmm. and David Burney. And that was John's first union film, I think, or his first studio film, I guess
is what he would
call it. And so we met on that. I actually had the honor of playing, I believe, the first lesbian in a television film.
Oh, wow.
But John, it was handled so beautifully in the scene. It was so it was so well written that I don't think anybody ever even picked up on it. You know?
Interesting. Had you seen Halloween at that point when you made the film?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I met John on Someone's Watching Me, mm-hmm. and then I believe he did Halloween after that.
Oh, okay.
And actually, Halloween was, to my recollection, except maybe Donovan's brain, the first horror film I'd ever seen. I've never seen Psycho or any of the classics, you know, Frankenstein or any of those. I didn't go to horror film. I didn't go to films as a growing up, you know. I didn't go to the theater or the movies. But I remember the night that I saw Halloween, John and I had just announced, our engagement on the Johnny Carson show.
Oh, wow.
And I went running from that studio to the screening that John was having of Halloween. And I had three friends meeting me there. Tom Atkins, who you know from The Fog.
Of course,
And Escape and Creepshow.
Yeah.
And Tom and I have done four films together. We've never been on screen together.
That's so
funny.
But
Tom Atkins and his wife, who was a very close friend of mine, she was one of the original Grease members. And then another girlfriend, also the original Frenchie from Grease.
Oh, wow.
Who then went on to play one of the two actresses in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, wow.
Marya Small. So first time I'd ever seen it, and I'm sitting next to John, and he was black and blue by the end of the night because I kept hitting him and screaming and screaming. And when it was all over, Tommy and Garn and Marya turned to each other and said, "We can't let her marry him." And that was my friend's introduction to the man that became my husband and my introduction to his work.
What am I getting myself
into? That was Halloween.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I love that story so much. So have you seen the new Halloween? Cody did the score.
His dad and Daniel Davies. I didn't see the new Halloween in the way that most people see it. I do video describing for the blind.
Oh, wow.
And so oftentimes I'm called in to do a series or a movie for the blind, people who mm-hmm. cannot see, so that in between the dialogue, I'm describing what's going on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I saw Halloween.
Wow. You know? So you're just describing the images?
She turns to him with a bemused look on her face. Or he picks up the knife and...
And do you...
That kind of thing.
Do you...
And it has to be done to a time code because it's got to be in between the
dialogue.
Of the
shots. Yeah. So do you, act it?
Well, I'm using my voice.
Right.
They don't want too much drama. But,
right.
You know, I am using... I mean, it's like reading a script. I'm reading a book.
Oh, I see. Yeah. You are creating that sense of the atmosphere.
Yes. If there's tension or if it's a comedy or you know, you sort of change your voice a little bit.
That's amazing. Well, we are going to take a really quick break, and we will come back with more Tales with Adrienne Barbeau.
Well, Alexis, we got big news.
Uh-oh.
Season one, done.
It's over.
Season two, coming at you hot.
3 years after
season one.
Technically
right.
Almost 4 years.
All right.
And now, listen,
here at Can I Pet Your Dog, the Smash It podcast, our seasons run for 3.5 years. And then in season two, we come at you with new hot co-hosts named you.
Hi, I'm Alexis.
And we also have
Field Troop.
Dog tech.
Yeah.
Dog news. Celebrity guests.
Oh, big shots.
We'll not let them talk about their resume.
Nope, only the dogs.
Only the dogs. I mean, if ever you were going to get into Can I Pet Your Dog?
Now's the time.
Get in here
every Tuesday
at MaximumFun.org.
Well, we are back, Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh. I'm speaking to Adrienne Barbeau, talking about 3 Days of the Condor and her amazing career in genre and sci-fi and all of that good stuff and theater and television and everything. I'm like, we got to get to Greece. Where we left off, you had just seen Halloween for the first time.
Yes.
With your new fiancé.
With my new fiancé who directed the film.
Yes, John Carpenter. So what was it like going from, you had this very successful career on Broadway doing Fiddler and Grease, and then you were on TV for a very long time in Maud, and then in the 80s, you started doing films with John Carpenter. And I mean, how did you sort of have to like adapt your performance style at all? Did you have to, you know, going from these different modes?
Yes. And it was a lesson learned the hard way. I mean, just through, you know, doing. Even going from stage to Maud,
right,
which is my first television experience, it took me a while to realize that I didn't have to create a character as I had with Rizzo or even with Huddle in Fiddler, who was so far afield from me that I had been hired because they saw something in me that was the quality they wanted for the character, you know, someone who could stand up to Bea Arthur's character, Maud, and yet still have a softness about her. And so in the beginning, I was, you know, I was working really hard.
Yeah.
And then I actually owe an enormous... Well, I'm going to tell one tale on myself that I don't think I've ever told this before, but it is, and it's fairly embarrassing.
Oh,
but so I came to L.A. I did Maud, and Maud was a sitcom, and we filmed it like a play.
Was it with a live audience?
Live audience, straight through.
Was it three cameras?
Four cameras.
Okay,
yeah,
wow.
Straight through, four cameras, and then I got hired to play Paul Michael Glazier's mistress in a TV movie about Houdini.
Okay.
And it was the first film that I had done. And we did the first scene. We did the master. And I went back to my trailer and changed clothes to get ready for the next scene. And the AD came, the assistant director came and said, okay, we're ready for the close-ups. And I thought, close-ups? What's close-ups? I didn't know anything about filmmaking. I mean, we'd shot the scene. As far as I was concerned, I was ready to go on to the next scene. Fortunately, I hadn't changed clothes, and he never knew.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, oh, they have over the shoulders, and they've got this setup and that setup. And
you're like, this crew is my live audience.
Who knew?
Yeah.
And then it was John Carpenter, who gave me my second big lesson in doing film. It was the first day of shooting for Someone's Watching Me.
Mm-hmm.
We did the scene, and John came up and said, that was great. Let's do it again and do less. And I said, do less? And he said, yeah, just do less. And it was the proverbial light bulb going off. Oh, my God. You know, this isn't the stage. I don't have to reach 1,500 people in the back.
Yes. School,
back row without a mic, which is the way we did, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Musical comedy in the 60s, 70s. And do less.
Right.
Let the camera do it. And that was a moment that I have carried through my entire life. It did not serve me well when time came to do Creepshow because George Romero kept saying, oh, no, you can go bigger. You can go bigger. And I thought, oh, my God, are you kidding me? Are you sure? You know, and because she's such an over-the-top character.
Right.
But I don't remember what your first question was, but
that
was my beginning of my film
career.
No,
just sort of adapting your, because you've had, you know, stage experience and TV experience,
yes,
and how does that translate to film? And it's interesting because you have worked with these really major figures of horror, like John Carpenter and Wes Craven, George Romero, like you were saying, and they must all have different styles of directing. And
you know, it's been many years since I've worked with those three fellows. But I don't believe their styles were that disparate. Mm. They all knew what they wanted. They all kept a very pleasant set. I mean, a very subdued set. I think one of his great talents is hiring the right people.
Yeah.
And then letting them do what they do. You know, not one of the three was open in my memory to improvisation. It wasn't that kind of work.
Right.
Which was fine with me. Especially coming from the stage, you know, I learned those words word for word. And even now I will go to a director before I'm ready to shoot and say, are you okay if I'd like to fudge this line a little bit or work with this? Because it's all about the words for me. The character comes from the words. But it was a joy to work with all three of them. Wes had the most difficult time just because he was so under-budgeted, which he didn't find out. I mean, they kept pulling the budget
out from under him.
So it was very difficult. He was having to make changes in the screenplay constantly and eliminate characters and, you know, do things like that.
And that was his first sci-fi film because he had done a couple of horror films. And then Swamp Thing was more a sci-fi.
I guess. Cartoon.
Yeah.
I mean,
like
I don't
comic
know what
book
they,
adaptation.
Comic book adaptation, yeah. But all three of them were just fantastic to work with.
It's interesting that you say, you know, John just said do less. And also about the hiring, because I have interviewed him before and he's just like, yep, I just hired the right, you know, I hired Jamie Lee Curtis and she was just Laurie Strode. And
she
had those qualities. And he's very concise in the words that he chooses, you know, like do less. So that, I'm like, that sounds exactly like him.
It worked. And all three fellows were great communicators.
Yeah, that's great.
Which is
very important.
What you want in a director, you know. It doesn't do any good to have somebody say, well, I want you to learn. And you're thinking, well, what does that mean?
Well, I was thinking a lot about your performance in The Fog. I mean, you're by yourself a lot of the time.
Hi, mateys. This is KAB Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. For the men of the seagrass. 15 miles out tonight. A warm hello. And keep a watch out for that fog bank heading in from the east.
It's just you and the microphone and having to act against just your intended radio audience against your microphone, especially in the scene where you're warning your son.
Dan, stay away from the door. Someone listen to me.
It's so emotional. I mean, how was that when you were shooting?
You know, people have asked me that over the years, and I don't think at the time I ever thought anything about it. I mean, maybe it was just because the words were so well written, or, I mean, I'm talking to him. I mean, he's just not there. I'm using the microphone to the ships at sea. You can hear my voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never had any trouble with it.
That's great. You do a beautiful job, though, you know, emoting against the lighthouse and the fog. I wonder if that was like the first time, because you have had such a storied voiceover career and that was such an iconic role as a radio DJ, if that was the first time you were like, oh, I've got a knack for this.
You know, I hated my voice when I was, even when I was doing Maude, maybe because B had such a bass voice. But I always thought my voice was, you know, really up high and everything. Mm-hmm. And John wrote the role for me.
Right.
So I had that going for me. And in the 60s, there was a disc jockey in Manhattan, I think it was WNEW, named Allison Steele, the Nightbird. Was her moniker. And I sort of remembered that. So I sort of, you know, this is Stevie Wayne, your nightlight or whatever. But I mean, I sort of ripped off Allison. I hope she doesn't mind.
You were inspired.
I was inspired by Allison.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the voice work, it sort of came as a surprise to me. I had just given birth to our son Cody, and I was looking for work that I could do that wouldn't take me away from him for any length of time. And I was approached by an agent at William Morris who had heard me on a game show, I think, $20,000 Pyramid or something. And she said, I think you've got a great voice for, you know, for doing commercials or animation or things like that. And this was in the day when name actors mm-hmm. were not doing this kind
right.
of thing.
Right. Now it's quite common.
Now it's, it's
the definitely. Way, the way to go.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So I went and took a course in animation because it's a technique. It's mm-hmm. an acting technique. I think that's the only course I took and sort of, again, learned on the job.
How long have you been Catwoman?
Catwoman was done in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I don't know when we premiered, but mm-hmm. that was one of those situations where I just got the call from the agency saying, you know, we've got an audition for you. Come on in. And I went, it's Catwoman. I never watched the cartoon when I was growing up. I knew Eartha Kitt,
right.
you know, because I used to sing Eartha Kitt songs when I was little. I don't know if I'd ever seen Lee, but anyway, I just went in and, you know, there's like six lines of dialogue and you say the words the way you think Catwoman would say them, or your idea of Catwoman.
That was for saving my cat.
Is that all it was for?
Maybe not.
I heard gunfire.
Occupational hazard.
Was getting into character for a voice role like Catwoman, I mean, is that similar to what you would do for an acting role?
When you're just using your voice, and so much of it, at least in cartoon animation, or at least so much of it for me in cartoon animation with Catwoman, was being supported by a fantastic director. But when you're just using your voice, you know, you need to know what's just gone on, who you're talking to, how you're feeling. I mean, it's in many ways, it's the same thing as mm-hmm. as being an actor with a script. Well, the story I always like to tell about doing Catwoman is the way we recorded, we were all in the room together whenever possible.
Oh, great.
I did do a couple from Toronto, I think, because I was on location doing something, so I was by myself. Mm-hmm. I just did, about 2 years ago, I played a 90-year-old French maid who was making love to Carl Reiner, and unfortunately, Carl wasn't in the room with me. That was on American Dad. So that's when you really have to use your imagination.
You're like, okay. Yeah. I'm getting into the mood.
But with Catwoman, we had the script. We had the words. We did not have the storyboards. So the director will say, okay, or you know, you're reading the thing and it says she jumps off the cliff. And so Catwoman jumps off the cliff and lands.
Yeah.
And the director then, who is looking at the storyboard, says, Adrienne, the cliff is 20 times taller than that. Oh, okay. You know, I mean, whatever. Yeah. Whatever sound you're going to do. You know, yeah. So it is a different technique, but... And I think you do have you. There are things you can learn about mm-hmm. doing animation that you might not have thought of before. Somebody said, "Let's, you know, what's going on here? What's going on in the scene?" Because you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did want to ask you about the other aspects of your career. I mean, you know, these were the roles that fans mostly know you for mm-hmm. these cult classic films. But I mean, you had this amazing storied career on Broadway, doing Fiddler with Bette Midler, mm-hmm. and obviously doing Grease and. Basically making the role of Rizzo, who, I mean, I'm a huge Grease fan, but, you know, I always associate with Stockard Channing. And then when I was reading that you were in the original Broadway cast,
yes.
I'm like, that's incredible. It's like, she's one of the most iconic characters in pop culture. What was that like to sort of bring this huge character to life?
You know, there are a lot of wonderful stories about that. I wrote about it in my memoir.
Mm-hmm.
There are worse things I could do.
I know.
Which named, I just, you know. Yeah.
Named after the Rizzo song.
The
yes.
song that Rizzo sings in the second act, which almost got cut.
Wow.
It wasn't working during previews. Not because of the song, but fortunately, I only learned this many years later. I think it was a woman named Betty Hunt, who was the publicist for the film. It wasn't working. There was something about it that wasn't working. And she came to them and said, look, it's the scene preceding it. And I don't even remember the script now. I don't remember. But we're not feeling a sympathy or empathy mm-hmm. for Rizzo because of the scene preceding it. So they rewrote the preceding scene. And I guess that made all the difference in the world, and the song stayed in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real heartbreaker of a song when you have the right emotional build up to it.
Yeah,
you know, she's such a tough character, and then you see her vulnerability, and you see her armor sort of crack in that song.
Yeah.
But you've never seen the film.
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to.
I bet it's hard.
You know, I mean, and I think what we did on stage in 1972 was pretty unique. And I know that it's not what is being done now anymore. I mean, the original show was very gritty. Mm-hmm. It was really sort of down and out. And it was not, I think, over the years, other directors have lightened it up and made it a little more bubblegummy and everything. And actually, the reason I've never seen the film is I was in a boutique one day and I heard the song from the film. I thought, what is that? And they had changed it so much from what we did.
Wow.
It seemed more jazzy and lighter. And I thought, oh, you know what? I don't think I want to see this.
Yeah.
I have such good memories
right.
about the original.
Let's just
leave it like that in our mind, mm-hmm. you know.
But so you were also in Pippin, which is an amazing show.
Yes. Yeah.
On Broadway? Or
No. Yeah. They asked me to do the national tour. I think I did most of 2015 and part of 2016, doing Andrea Martin's role,
yes.
hanging upside down
yes,
from the
hanging
trapeze
upside down.
And singing the song. And, it was great fun.
Oh, and so what was that like being on tour? That must have been a new experience.
That was a new experience for me. I had never, I mean, when I first started in 65, I had done summer stock, mm-hmm. you know, but this was a whole new experience. And I think the best part about it, aside from doing the role, was getting to know parts of the country, cities in the country, that I never would have explored,
right.
and discovering places that I really thought, this is a wonderful town to come back to, you know. And then we got to go to Amsterdam for 6 weeks.
Right.
And
so you spend like about a month in each city, or like
no,
3 weeks?
1 week.
1 week, okay.
1 week in some, 2 weeks in others.
Okay.
I think we were 2 weeks in Dallas and maybe 2 weeks in Houston and Chicago and the bigger cities. But a week in Grand Rapids, which has this beautiful sculpture garden, just incredible sculpture.
And you're like, never knew.
Never knew, never knew. Fayetteville, Arkansas, which I was incredibly impressed with. Greenville, South Carolina, I think. And
that's a fun experience to have that,
yes,
that tour,
yeah.
tour life.
Because I've always thought, oh, I'm going to take a vacation, I'll go to Europe. But I never would have been to these places, and it was very gratifying.
Wow. Well, let's take another quick break on Switchblade Sisters.
We are the host of My Brother, My Brother and Me, and now, nearly 10 years into our podcast, the secret can be revealed. All the clues are in place, and the world's greatest treasure hunt can now begin.
Embedded in each episode of My Brother, My Brother and Me is a micro clue that will lead you to 14 precious gemstones all around this big, beautiful blue world of ours.
So start combing through the episodes. Let's say starting at episode 101 on.
Yeah, the early episodes are pretty problematic, so there's no clues in those episodes.
No, not at all.
The better ones, the good ones, clues ahoy.
Listen to every episode repeatedly in sequence. Laugh if you must, but mainly get all the great clues. My Brother, My Brother and Me, it's an advice show, kind of, but a treasure hunt, mainly. Anywhere you find podcasts or treasure maps, My Brother and Me, the hunt is on.
All right, we are back on Switchblade Sisters with the amazing Adrienne Barbeau. So there is some interesting background on how 3 Days of the Condor got made. Producer Dino De Laurentiis originally wanted Warren Beatty to play the role of Joe Turner.
Interesting.
And he wanted Peter Yates, who directed Bullet, to direct. But Warren Beatty was dragging his feet, so then De Laurentiis went to Redford. But Redford was the one who said he wanted Sidney Pollack to direct.
Oh.
And they had originally met on a film in 1962 called War Hunt that they were both acting in, because Sidney Pollack started out as an actor. So they became best friends on War Hunt, and then they did Jeremiah Johnson, The Way We Were, and all of those great films from the 70s. And Sidney Pollack actually directed Redford in like 7 films.
Wow.
So that was a long collaboration, and this kind of falls right into the middle of it. But because Redford had just signed on to do All the President's Men, which I know is a favorite one film of yours.
Other film that I've seen more than once.
which is impressive because it's a very long film. But it's so good. It's like a 3-hour movie that feels like 90 minutes. Like, yes. It's all about the pacing, yes. You know? I love All the President's Men.
I do too.
But it is kind of similar to kind of the milieu of 3 Days of the Condor. So he asked them to change the location from D.C. to New York when they were shooting. But I love the New York aspect of Three Days of the Condor. That scene is so great when they go into the deli and he's kind of talking smack with the regulars.
Right.
And of course, in my mind, I'm like, oh, they're going to have to be his alias for something. And that didn't come up, you know?
His alibi.
His alibi and his alias. That did not come back. It was just a little bit of local color.
And even the scene where Faye Dunaway is shopping.
Right.
She's buying mountaineering clothes, isn't she?
Skiing clothes.
Skiing clothes to go. There was something memorable about that had to do with the fact that it was in New York.
They,
I don't know.
They really get the details right. And also the fact that the CIA headquarters are in the World Trade Center, mm-hmm. the Twin Towers, which was really interesting to see all those shots again of them, the big helicopter shots. But it's interesting that, you know, Redford had so much say over like how this would, you know, was going to go. And even Pollock was sort of like bringing in the love story and changing the story, I think it really makes it more than it could have been, you know, because he kind of said it was like a cheesy paperback thriller originally, the book. And then it turns it into something that felt really immediate to me and very like on the street. You really sense the danger that Redford is in.
Yes. Yeah. And timely enough that they redid it for network, whatever for, network it was.
Network, I have never.
It was either Netflix. Oh, you said you thought it was Audience.
I think it was called Audience.
It may have been Audience. Yeah.
The other interesting thing is that the film was a big influence on Captain America Winter Soldier, which definitely has like a 70s paranoid thriller vibe to it, a little Parallax view to it. But Robert Redford is also in that film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know if you're a Marvel fan, but he plays a character, and Anthony Russo, who is one of the directors, said that his casting was a direct homage to 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, for heaven's sake. All right.
But yeah, Anthony Russo said, "We've joked that you could call the movie 3 Days of Captain America because it owes such a creative debt to that movie. A very likable character gets sucked into a web of intrigue. Very violent forces are trying to kill him, and they have a grand plan which they're trying to protect, which is why they have to kill him." So it's really these like very elemental story ideas of, you know, no matter what the CIA plot is about oil fields, it's like all it is like man on the run.
Right.
Fighting for his life.
Who's the good guy and who's the bad guy?
Doesn't
who
know
can he
who
trust?
To trust. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think those ideas of trust were big for Sidney Pollack as well. He talked a lot about those themes of trust, even in the relationship with Faye Dunaway, where, you know, she starts to figure out if she can trust him. Mm-hmm. And so it's like happening on all these different levels throughout the film. So I think that's what makes it something that lasts so long, that has such a, you know, lasting impact.
Yeah.
I've asked you about working with Carpenter, Craven, Romero, but the question on everyone's mind is, what's it like to work with B. Arthur?
Well, Carol, tell me, did they give it to you? Did they give it to you?
Boy, did they give it to me.
Honey, what happened?
I got a $25 a week raise.
Hey, that's terrific. This calls for a celebration.
Oh, let's open a bottle of sangria and just toast ourselves silly.
Vivian, Arthur White, this raise is not good news.
I love B. I just loved her. And it took me years. I took it so for granted at the time because I'd never done TV. And I just assumed everybody was as brilliant as she was, but as giving as she was, as professional as she was, as concerned only with the quality of the product as she was, you know. Mm-hmm. I just thought everybody was like that. But Norman Lear always hired theater actors whenever he could.
Oh, wow.
We were all from the New York theater. Bill Macy had been in O Calcutta mm-hmm. right before he did Maud. B came from New York theater. Esther Rolle, Conrad Bain. We were all trained stage actors. So we all brought that to the theater.
Mm-hmm. And is that like that sense of professionalism, that yes. sense of dedication?
Yes. Yes. Okay. But B was, she was the first one in the rehearsal hall. She was the last one to leave. She was the first one at the table reads to say, you know, I think this joke would work better if Adi said it, or if Conrad said it, or Bill said it. She totally giving. There was no ego. She didn't suffer fools if you weren't doing the work.
Oh, I'm sure.
She, you know, but she was the first one up from the table if we had a guest artist to go and greet them and bring them in. And since then, having done many guest appearances on many shows, that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the case that your star is showing up for rehearsal,
right,
which
right.
was a big yes. shock to me later on. But
there
I
is a standard. There is a B. Arthur standard.
Yes, yes, and of course, I mean nobody can hold
that.
A take yes. like she can.
Oh.
You know, nobody can deliver a line like
oh,
she
gosh.
Can.
Oh so gosh,
I learned. I'm sure I learned maybe 60 or 70 or 80% of my comedy timing from B.
That's amazing.
You know, I mean, I've been doing musical comedy mm-hmm. up until then, and you know it, but. Not
but there's
like
something
me.
that sitcom timing, that yes. holding, that
yes.
delivery. And
yes.
she just,
yes.
I mean, she's sort of the gold standard for that.
Yes. And even we did two shows back to back. We'd do a dress rehearsal, we would call it, for an audience, filmed straight through. And then the writers would go upstairs and rewrite. This joke didn't work. We're too long. We've got to cut this, blah, 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 blah. And while we're having dinner, we're memorizing new lines, new blocking, new dialogue and everything. B had it.
Wow.
By, you know, we finished the first show, we'd finished taping at 6, let's say, and we started the second one at 8, and mm-hmm. she had it down.
You've been on some great TV shows. For the horror fans, obviously Dexter, but Carnival on HBO,
Carnival.
Sons of Anarchy. I mean, what was it like being on Carnival?
Carnival was one of my all-time favorite jobs.
Wow.
And I say job because it wasn't just the role that made it so wonderful. We filmed in Simi Valley, not mm-hmm. far from my home. And there were so many of us in the cast that I never worked maybe more than 3 days a week or 4 days a week at the most. So I could raise my kids, you know,
nice.
I could get them to school mm-hmm. and most of the time pick them up. And it was the ideal job for me at the time. And the cast was brilliant. The scripts were brilliant. I was completely enthralled with the metaphysical aspect mm-hmm. of the show.
That's one show that I think could have had a few more seasons or a movie.
Had it had one more,
yeah.
it really would have broken out, I think. We were just finding our
right.
audience. But it was an
unique...
expensive show to
oh,
produce. And HBO had just come off of major numbers with Sopranos mm-hmm. and 6 Feet Under. And we weren't garnering the crossover audience early enough on.
Mm-hmm.
But the writers were brilliant and everybody in the cast. It was a wonderful experience.
You're still doing a ton of work. You have films coming out.
I do.
And I'm curious to hear about the Creepshow
oh, yes.
remake,
yeah.
which is going to be on Shudder.
Yes.
And there's a new Swamp Thing series.
Swamp Thing for DC Universe.
Okay.
Yes, with Jennifer Beals and Virginia Madsen and
oh.
Will Patton, Derek Mears, and Crystal Reed from Gotham.
Do you ever think about your legacy as one of the Scream Queens? Do you consider yourself a Scream Queen?
I don't think about my legacy, no.
Oh.
None of us, when we were making those wonderful films in the 80s, ever thought that 40 years later, we would have this huge revitalization of response, mm-hmm. I guess you'd say. It's incredible. It's
yeah.
remarkable, and it's wonderful and very gratifying.
Yeah.
And, but
for it to be appreciated, you know, what
yeah.
after so many years and they were kind of looked down upon and when they came out in a way.
Well, I mean, they were just movies,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
now they're movies.
Right, exactly. There's a new sense of importance
yeah.
conveyed onto them, yeah. Well, I'm a huge fan of that genre, so it's always fun to talk about those movies and to revisit that. Is there anything else that you want to discuss before we wrap up this
no,
fun conversation?
No, this has been wonderful.
I know.
I do have a bunch of
You have some films that
I
are premiering.
I have some films in the can.
Yeah.
I have one film that is premiering May 31st, actually, in Spain. I just came back from Bilbao, the Fant Film Festival, where it was in competition. And it just won the Silver Wings Award for Best Screenplay at the Alicante Festival.
Oh, wow.
It's called The Chain. And, oh, by the way, it reunites Ray Wise and myself.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to see
Ray
this.
Ray is starring. Ray and John Patrick Amadori are starring. And my, unfortunately, my best scene got cut for time purposes, but you'll have to wait for the DVD on that. It's in the director's cut.
But you and Ray Wise back
I'm
together.
I'm playing husband and wife.
Wow.
And it's a psychological thriller, and it's quite interesting.
Okay, so The Chain. We'll keep an eye out for that.
And on June 13th, I believe it is, at Grauman's Chinese, a film, I just did a cameo, but it's a wonderful film called Appleseed.
Appleseed.
Rance Howard's last film.
Oh, wow.
And it's, and Clint Howard is in it.
Oh, wow.
And Michael Wirth, who wrote it and directed it. And it's, it is the opening night film for the Dances with Films Festival. At Grauman's Chinese.
Here in Hollywood.
That one's that. And then I did a comedy with Amber Liu, the K-pop artist.
Oh.
And Dan Loria.
Cool.
And that is called The Eagle and the Albatross. I think we'll be seeing that in October. I have another one where I just did a cameo called Hoax that
you
is
just
going
are
to be coming out. And there's a couple more in post-production. I don't know what's going on with them. But
that's amazing.
Oh, and I have, aside from Swamp Thing and Creepshow, I did just a guest episode, but it's such a wonderful series that will be coming to Netflix.
Oh.
With RuPaul.
What is it?
And Izzy G is, and it's called AJ and the Queen.
Oh.
And it's from Michael Patrick King, who did Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And it's, I just was so taken with project. It's,
All right. We'll have to keep an eye out.
Keep an eye out for AJ and the Queen on
You
Netflix.
Have like nine projects coming out. This is amazing. I'm so, you are just working a lot. That's incredible.
And she killed.
And she kills. Listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
I've listened to it.
Thank you.
Well, Adrian, this has been such a pleasure.
Thanks
very
much. Thank
you so much for talking to us about your wonderful career and about 3 days of the Condor.
Yes.
And thank you so much for being on Switchblade Sisters. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Here's one from Bas Javu. April Wolf is a fresh voice in film criticism, thank God, who brings incredible research, thoughtful questions, and wonderful guests to her show. She's exposed me to artists I might not have known or given much thought to otherwise, and she helps contribute to the growing legitimacy of genre film analysis. I'm so grateful for the show as a cis, white, hetero male sick of listening to cis, white, hetero males talk to this about the same 10 movies over and over again. Yes, Bas Baju. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. That is tongue twister. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.